Rockefeller's leading opponent for the nomination, the figures were similar, 13% for Nelson Rockefeller and 77% for Johnson. Richard Nixon, who had taken himself out of the running, would do better against the president, Gallup found, but not much better. 24% to 68% for Johnson. Time magazine said the identity of the Republican nominee didn't really matter. President Johnson's rising popularity had made the whole show academic. Chapter 26. Long Enough. Lyndon Johnson's succession to the presidency, the transition in which he assumed the power that had once been John Kennedy's, had been so successful, gone so smoothly, that by March, as was apparent from the contemporary journalistic evaluation, it was becoming simply a fait accompli, an accepted fact of American political life. And as more time passed, that would turn out to be its fate over a longer term as well. Some of those who witnessed the succession up close, appreciating the magnitude of his accomplishment, were certain that eventually it would be given the credit it deserved. History will record the great contribution Lyndon Johnson made in taking us through the transition, Hugh Sidey wrote in 1969. That has not happened, however. The success, the smoothness of Johnson's succession has come to be viewed, to the extent it is viewed at all, as simply yet another example of the efficacy of the American Constitution's provisions for the orderly transfer of presidential power in a democracy. Of the efficacy, as one of the most detailed studies of vice presidential succession puts it, of the recognized rule which made him president upon the death of the president. The smooth manner in which presidential power changed hands upon the death of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was not entirely unlike what had happened on seven other occasions in American history, this study states. Each time a vice president became president and led the country safely through the tragedy and crisis of losing its leader. Not that history has forgotten the assassination of President Kennedy and the three subsequent days of his funeral ceremonies, of course. The very opposite is the case. Those 4 days have become enshrined as among the most memorable days in American history. But the achievements of Lyndon Johnson during those 4 days and the rest of the transition period, the period 47 days, just short of 7 weeks, between the moment on November 22, 1963, when Ken O'Donnell said, "He's gone," and the State of the Union speech on January 8, 1964, have been afforded so little attention that his succession to the presidency has become, to a considerable extent, an episode, if not lost to, then overlooked by, history. There are photographs and moving pictures of the assassination day and the funeral ceremonies, whose inherent drama and constant reiteration on television, in movies, in books, in newspapers and magazines, in every form of media really in which the reiteration of images is possible, have engraved them so deeply in the American consciousness that they have become iconic images in the nation's history. Jack and Jackie, tanned and radiant, coming off Air Force One in Dallas, pink suit and red roses, bright in the sun, and sitting, smiling, basking in the cheers in the back seat of the open car. The president suddenly slumping in Zapruder's lens. Bobby and Jackie, hand in hand in sorrow, coming off the plane, dark blotches on the suit. Jackie coming out of the White House holding her children's hands, black mantilla, little sky blue coats. The caisson with its 6 matched grays, prancing black Jack with boots reversed. Caroline putting her hand under the flag. John John's salute. Oswald, his mouth open in shock and agony. The Stetsoned Dallas detective aghast as the menacing figure lunges in from the right, revolver in hand. The great procession up Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol, the great procession on foot to the cathedral, the three Kennedys, the two brothers and the veiled widow, behind them the world leaders massed and marching. A single photograph from those 4 days, and a simple photograph only, in which Lyndon Johnson is prominent, has become iconic. It is perhaps the most famous photograph of them all, the picture of the new president taking the oath aboard Air Force One. But although his face is the focus of the camera's eye, it is a face that is only stern and sad and composed, certainly not handsome, and the viewer's eye moves quickly to the face beside his, the very mask of beauty and grief. And that photograph is the only image of Lyndon Johnson during those 4 days that has become a part of history. Although during those days he was becoming the most powerful man on earth. When he appears in other photographs, it is not at the center. He is there behind the Kennedy family coming down the steps of the Capitol after the service in the rotunda. But as the faces of the grieving Kennedys fill the lens, who looks to see who is behind them? What the world saw on television the day of the procession of Kennedys and world leaders following the casket to the cathedral, and what the world has seen over and over during the intervening half-century, is, behind the Kennedys, Selassie's medals and towering de Gaulle and Baudouin's sword. Johnson is marching, too, right behind the family and in front of the leaders, marching, windows all along the route, with gunshots from a window fresh in his mind. But thanks to the vagaries of camera angles, he is barely visible in most photographs of the procession. But the succession of Lyndon Johnson deserves a better fate in history. For had it not been for his accomplishments during the transition, history might have been different. Because the headlines in that first blizzard of news, "Prisoner linked to Castro group, suspect lived in Soviet Union," have long been proven false or exaggerated, it has been easy to forget that for several days after the assassination, America was reading those headlines. Easy to forget the extent of the suspicions that existed during those days, not only about a conspiracy, but about a conspiracy hatched in Cuba or Russia, two nations with whom barely a year before America had been on the brink of nuclear war. If Johnson had not moved as quickly as he did to appoint the Warren Commission and quiet the suspicions, would suspicions have escalated into an international crisis? Perhaps not. And certainly the commission's investigation, which would in its turn be rushed, has been proven inadequate, its report flawed. The answer to that question is not simple, however. International misunderstandings have escalated into war because of folly and illogic before. Guns of August? In weighing the motivations, mixed as always with Johnson for establishing the Warren Commission, the possibility of November bombs should be allowed at least a small place on the scales. Nor should other aspects of the transition be passed over as lightly as they have been. Because he moved so swiftly and successfully to create the image of continuity that reassured the nation, it has been easy to overlook how the Kennedy men might simply have resigned. It has been easy to overlook the obstacles, the shock and mystery of the assassination, the mushroom cloud fears, the deep divisions in the country over his predecessor's policies, that stood in the way of unifying America behind his administration. Easy to overlook how difficult to unify even his own party, to rally into line behind his administration's banner, labor leaders, black leaders, liberals, many of whom had for years been deeply suspicious of him and who would have needed little excuse to fall irrevocably into line behind another more familiar banner, the brothers' banner, that could so readily have been raised within party ranks, to fall into line behind a leader they knew and were quickly beginning to love. And Lyndon Johnson's achievements during those 7 weeks went far beyond reassurance and continuity, far beyond even what he accomplished during those weeks for his predecessor's tax cut bill and civil rights. For had he striven only for reassurance and continuity, something much more important would have been lost. The bullets of Dallas had made John F. Kennedy a martyr, and the martyrdom of a leader lends new power to causes he had championed. Lyndon Johnson knew this. "Everything I had ever learned in the history books taught me that martyrs have to die for causes," he explained to Doris Goodwin. "John Kennedy had died, but his cause was not really clear. That was my job. I had to take the dead man's program and turn it into a martyr's cause." He began to do that when, in that first address to Congress on November 27th, he said he was trying to finish what Kennedy had started, to continue the forward thrust of America that he began. He couched his support of legislation in those terms. "No memorial could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long." During the transition, he was constantly invoking the late president's memory, and the invocations accomplished their purpose. JFK's martyrdom had galvanized support for the causes with which he had identified himself in his eloquent speeches. Kennedy's assassination touched many people as they had not been touched before, as an historian has written, Could the murder of so young and promising a leader be redeemed? Must his life be wasted? The passage of legislation he had introduced was a way of ensuring it wouldn't be wasted. His death generated behind legislation that had seemed dead in congressional waters a tremendous new momentum. And Johnson knew something else. Momentum can be lost. A measure must be sent to the Hill at exactly the right moment, he was to explain. Timing is essential. Momentum is not a mysterious mistress. It is a controllable fact of political life. The time to catch a wave is at its crest, and while the wave of emotion, of affection and adoration for the martyred young president would roll on for decades, is still rolling on today, almost half a century after Dallas, its crest, the height of the Kennedy tide, came in the weeks immediately following Dallas, in the weeks of Lyndon Johnson's transition. By rushing to push through Kennedy's bills, Johnson caught the crest. The maneuvers by which he made them begin to move through Congress were made easier, in some cases were only made possible, by that wave of emotion. Had he not caught the tide at its absolute height, he might well have lost some of its force. And as the Senate fight of 1964 was to demonstrate, every ounce of that force would be necessary to pass the Civil Rights Bill. By moving as quickly as he did, Johnson caught a tide, seized a moment that might not have lasted very long. Caught the tide, and rode the tide, using its force as it rolled forward beyond the transition weeks into the new year of 1964, using it for more than the passage of the civil rights and tax cut bills, or for the yanking of the bit out of Congress's teeth, using the momentum generated by John Kennedy's death for other purposes, using it, in fact, for purposes beyond those Kennedy had enunciated, for the passage of long-dreamed-of liberal legislation whose purposes went far beyond any embodied in Kennedy legislation. Lyndon Johnson used that momentum to launch what he envisioned as, and what in fact might have been had it not been undermined and then destroyed by a war he waged in the jungles of Asia and by the deceptions he practiced in the name of that war, a vast revolutionary transformation of America, a war on poverty that would, in his vision, be the beginning of the transformation of American society into the Great Society. His declaration that this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America was a prelude to the introduction of legislation that would launch the war on dozens of new fronts. These 7 weeks, the 7 weeks between November 22nd and January 8th, were therefore a period in which there took place in the capital of the greatest republic in the Western world a remarkable demonstration of the passage of power. Immense power, of its passing in an instant from one hand to another, and of its wielding by that new hand in the first weeks after it closed on that power, with changing effectiveness. On one level, the passage was a demonstration of how, in very difficult circumstances, unique circumstances, circumstances for which there existed no precedents to provide guidance, to grasp the reins of a democratic government in a crisis created by the assassination of the head of state and hold the government stable, steady on its course. But this passage was a demonstration of the art of government on a higher level than reassurance or stability. The higher use Lyndon Johnson made of these 7 weeks, the use he made of the crisis, using it, using the transition as a platform from which to launch a crusade for social justice on a vast new scale, made these weeks not only a dramatic and sorrowful, but a pivotal moment in the history of the United States. For Lyndon Johnson to have accomplished this, he had had to overcome governmental and political obstacles that had stood in the path of social justice for a century, and that for most of the last quarter of that century, since the last great liberal tide ran out in 1937, had been obstacles that could not be overcome. The congressional resistance and the power of the South that had blocked civil rights and social welfare legislation, for instance. And in addition, he had to overcome another obstacle that had nothing to do with government or politics, but only with himself. So potent an aspect of his character had the fear of failure been throughout his life, for example, that it had all but paralyzed him in his attempt to reach for the presidency, no matter how deep his yearning for the office. When the office was suddenly thrust upon him, however, when there was suddenly no longer room for doubts or hesitation, when he had to act, he acted. If there were fears or doubts, no one saw them. Gone from Lyndon Johnson during the transition also are the outward manifestations of other aspects of his personality that had been prominent at every other stage of his career. The frenetic, frantic arm-waving, almost desperate demeanor that had characterized so much of his life was, during this transition period, replaced by a disciplined calmness. As for the alarm clock inside him that told him at least once an hour to go chew somebody out, to blow his top, it went off seldom, if ever, during this period. During these weeks, there was usually, in fact, an underlying note of courtesy when he asked an aide to perform some chore. And as one aide said, "I've never seen him so composed." Composed, calm, self-possessed, humility, self-discipline, these were the words used to describe him during these weeks. The boastful, gloating quality was gone, even with enemies over whom he now had power. The words, "He isn't president anymore, I am." During the transition, did those words slip out more than once? More than the single time he could not resist saying them, or a close version of them, to Robert Kennedy? Other qualities that had always been prominent in him vanished. Not only the bellowing, the jabbing of hands, the waving of arms, and the rushing of words that had invariably alienated audiences and made his speeches ineffective, but deeper-rooted qualities as well. Almost at once, the whining, self-pitying caricature of Throttlebottom vanished, George Reedy was to write. During this whole period, there was no trace of the ugly arrogance which had made him so disliked in many quarters. The situation brought out the finest that was in him. The necessity for subduing these qualities, for keeping them under control, may have been obvious to Lyndon Johnson as he assumed the presidency, so clear was it that they would prevent him from accomplishing his goals. They would, for one thing, have made it more difficult for him in dealing with the Kennedy cabinet and White House staffers. A yielding nature had not been a criterion for staff hiring in the Kennedy administration. Most Kennedy men, not all, but most, were therefore men who would not be amenable to his methods of control. Having observed those methods, these men were determined not to submit themselves to them. Wary of signs that he might intend them to do so, they might leave at the first hint that he would treat them as he treated Jenkins and Reedy, as indeed the one member of the Kennedy team with whom Lyndon Johnson did slip, Pierre Salinger, left as fast as he could. Other slips could trigger the mass exodus he feared. In dealing with the House and Senate, moreover, his usual methods wouldn't help and might hurt, because a key method had always been threats, and threats didn't work without power behind them, and during these first weeks of his presidency, when he was still trying to understand such fundamentals as the elements of the budget and was operating against deadlines, the Christmas recess, the budget submission deadlines that made maneuvering difficult, he still hadn't consolidated his power sufficiently to use it extensively in his relations with Congress. Yet obvious as may have been the necessity for subduing these qualities, for him to subdue them must have been very difficult. They had not, after all, been eliminated from his nature. They were still there, powerful as ever, as will be seen all too clearly in the next volume of this work. Lyndon Johnson had grasped in an instant what needed to be done with Kennedy's men and Kennedy's legislation. His insight into the crisis and the rapidity of his response to it, a glimpse of political genius almost shocking in its acuity and decisiveness. But the genius in knowing what he needed to do was no more vital in the crisis than the self-discipline and strength of will that enabled him to do it. Accomplishing what was needed required him to subdue and to conceal elements of his nature that he had never before concealed or subdued, elements so basic to his personality that they had, in fact, governed his behavior during all of his previous life. Yet he subdued them, overcame them in a triumph not only of genius, but of will. As I said at the beginning of this book, it is not an examination of Lyndon Johnson's entire presidency, but only of its first phase, and the longer story will be very different in tone. The interruptions in the Life and Senate Rules Committee investigations would be brief. Don Reynolds would soon be back in Senator Williams's office. By August, Life would be running its net worth story, and newspapers would be running their own articles. And the tone would be different in other areas as well. The presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson would be a presidency marked by victories. His great personal victory in the 1964 election, and his great victories for legislation that is the legislative embodiment of the liberal spirit in all its nobility, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Medicare and Medicaid, Head Start, Model Cities, government's hand to help people caught in the tentacles of circumstance. Yet victories would not, as it turned out, be the only hallmarks that would make the presidency of Lyndon Johnson vivid in history. "We shall overcome" were not the only words by which it will be remembered. "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" The choruses of the great civil rights hymns were not the only memorable choruses of the Lyndon Johnson years. "Waist deep in the big muddy and the big fool says to push on." 58,000 dead, 300,000 wounded, the amputations, the blindness, the terrible scars of body and mind. Men looking down at the space where their legs used to be. And 58,000 and 300,000 are the numbers only of the American dead and wounded. Not all of them during his presidency. The Vietnam War would continue more than 4 years after he left office. But virtually all of them after he escalated the war into an American war. The number of Vietnamese, South and North Vietnamese soldiers and civilians, killed and wounded is not in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. It may be, no one has yet made a complete estimate, more than 2 million men and women and children killed and maimed and burned alive, some by bombs dropped on villages selected as targets by Johnson himself, dropped by B-52s, which flew so high that they were not only invisible but unheard from the ground, so that the people in the villages did not know they were in danger until the bombs hit. Nor can the losses incurred during the Johnson presidency be measured only in numbers. It is difficult to remember, much less to understand, the extent to which the president, any president, was revered, respected, before Lyndon Johnson, Tom Wicker was to write shortly after Johnson's presidency ended. Difficult to remember so thoroughly had respect and reverence for the institution disappeared during that presidency. It is difficult for most Americans today, more than 40 years, 2 generations after that presidency ended, to remember or to understand such reverence for a president or for the institution of the presidency, so lasting has been the damage inflicted on it. While much of the damage was inflicted by Richard Nixon, Johnson's successor, it was under Johnson that the damage began. The story of the presidency of Lyndon Johnson will be different in tone from the story of the transition, in part because the elements of his personality absent during the transition were shortly to reappear. Yet for a period of time, a brief but crucial moment in history, he had held these elements in check, had overcome them, had, in a way, conquered himself. And by doing so, by overcoming forces within him that were very difficult to overcome, he not only had held the country steady during a difficult time, but had set it on a new course, a course towards social justice. In the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson, this period stands out as different from the rest, as perhaps that life's finest moment, as a moment not only masterful, but, in its way, heroic. If he had held in check these forces within him, had conquered himself for a while, he wasn't going to be able to do it for very long. But he had done it long enough. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Book 4 in The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Passage of Power, by Robert A. Caro. Copyright 2012 by Robert A. Caro, Inc. Performed by Grover Gardner. Performance copyright 2012 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417. Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Book 4 in The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Passage of Power, by Robert A. Carroll. Performed by Grover Gardner. Dedication for Ina, and for Chase and Carla, and for Barry, Shauna, and Jesse. With love. Introduction. What the hell's the presidency for? Air Force One, the president's plane, is divided behind the crew's cockpit into three compartments. In the first of them, just behind the cockpit, women sat weeping and Secret Service agents were trying to hold back tears. "You've heard of strong men crying. Well, we had it there that day," recalls a reporter. As the pilot lifted the big jet off the Dallas runway in a climb so steep that to a man standing on the ground it seemed almost vertical, leveled off for a few minutes, and then, warned that there were tornadoes between him and Washington, put the plane into another climb to get above them. In the rear compartment, the widow, her suit stained with blood, was sitting next to the coffin of the dead president. And in the center compartment was the new president. Lyndon Johnson hadn't been aboard Air Force One on the trip down to Texas. He had long since given up asking John F. Kennedy if he could accompany him on the presidential plane when they were flying to the same destination. "You don't mean to say that Mr. Johnson is again insisting on riding with me?" Kennedy had once asked his secretary in an exasperated tone. As he had given up on all his attempts to obtain some measure of recognition, or at least dignity, as vice president. Once, as Senate Majority Leader, he had been a mighty figure, the second most powerful man in the country. But that seemed a long time ago now. Although initially he had been favored to win the Democratic nomination for president, he had been outmaneuvered by the younger man, and having accepted the vice presidency, had, in that post, become not just powerless, but a figure of ridicule. The jibe, whatever became of Lyndon Johnson, that had started over Georgetown dinner tables, was now in headlines over articles about his predicament. He himself was worried about whether or not he would be retained on the 1964 Democratic ticket, and was convinced that whether he was or not, his dreams of becoming president one day were over. He had advised more than one aide whom he would have wanted with him were he to run for or become president to leave his staff. "My future is behind me," he told one member of his staff. "Go," he said to another, "I'm finished." But he was on Air Force One now. In part, this book is the story of the 5 years, from late 1958, when Johnson began campaigning for the presidency, to November 22, 1963, before that flight from Dallas to Washington. A story of how a man who all his life had yearned for the presidency failed in his great chance to attain that goal, of how, to a large degree because of aspects of his character that crippled him in his efforts to attain it, he allowed the prize for which he had planned and schemed and worked with a tirelessness that made an ally say, "I never thought it was possible for anyone to work that hard," to be snatched away from him. It is a story of not only failure, but humiliation, of how, after he had lost the presidential nomination in 1960, he had taken a gamble, giving up the Senate leadership to accept the vice presidential nomination, because he felt that was his only remaining chance to achieve his goal, and of what followed after he became vice president. Although Kennedy might not have won in 1960 without his presence on the ticket and his old-fashioned whistle-stop campaigning, a fact that Kennedy himself privately acknowledged, he received no credit for that. "Power is where power goes," he had boasted in explaining why he had traded in the Senate leadership. He would be able, through his political gifts, to transform the traditionally powerless vice presidency. But when, not long after the election, he had made two attempts, one with the Senate, one with Kennedy himself, to grab powers no previous vice president had enjoyed, both were carried out in ways so clumsy and embarrassing that it was obvious that not his old skills, but only desperation was behind them. And during the 3 years since Kennedy had turned aside with contemptuous ease Johnson's attempt to maneuver him into ceding a portion of presidential power. Vice President Johnson had become, among Kennedy's White House aides, the object of dislike and distrust, and of derision embodied in the mocking nicknames by which they often referred to him, Uncle Cornpone or Rufus Cornpone. These nicknames, and 100 other slights, make this part of the book also a story about what being without power can mean in a city in which power is the name of the game, in a city as cruel as Washington. That part of the story, the 5-year part, had ended when Kennedy's aide Kenneth O'Donnell had walked into the cubicle in Dallas's Parkland Hospital, in which Lyndon Johnson, standing all but motionless against a wall, had been waiting for long minutes for definitive word on the president's fate. Seeing Kenny's stricken face, I knew, Lady Bird Johnson was to say, even before O'Donnell said, "He's gone." And in part, this book is the story of a period that began during that flight, for it was on Air Force One, after he had sworn the oath of office with Jacqueline Kennedy standing beside him in a sweltering, dimly lit cabin, its window shades closed to foil would-be assassins, that his first presidential decisions were made, that the transition between the Kennedy administration and that of Lyndon Baines Johnson began. That story, the transition story, a story just 7 weeks long, its end came, as will be seen, on January 8, 1964, is a story of a period in Lyndon Johnson's life very unlike that of the preceding 5 years. Although 7 times previously in the history of the American Republic a presidential transition had come about not through election but through death, the death of a president in office, and in 3 of those 7 instances death had come by assassination rather than through natural causes, the Johnson transition took place in circumstances that made it in some ways different from, and in some ways more difficult than, any of its predecessors. The very jolt of the news was different. As the first assassination to take place in the age of television, it was the first an entire nation learned about almost at the same moment. By the time Air Force One touched down in Washington after a flight of 2 hours and 6 minutes, 92% of the American people had heard the news, which crossed the country, Newsweek said, like a shockwave. Tens of millions of Americans saw the coffin, escorted by Jacqueline and Robert Kennedy, descend from the plane on an hydraulic lift. And hard on the first shock came others. 40 minutes into Air Force One's flight, it was announced that a Dallas policeman had been shot. And a few minutes later that a 24-year-old man had been arrested for questioning, and a half hour later that he was a definitive suspect in the assassination. And on the heels of Lee Harvey Oswald's name came rumors that seemed to link him to both Cuba and the Soviet Union. With America barely a year past the Cuban Missile Crisis, the fears that had accompanied the realization in October 1962 that the country was on the very brink of a nuclear confrontation with those two countries were still fresh in America's mind. And then, 2 days later, the assassin was assassinated on live television. The shadowy figure lunging onto the screen from the right, glimpses of a pistol. "He's been shot! He's been shot! Lee Harvey Oswald has been shot!" For one moment of total horror, the New York Times said, nothing could quite compare with the killing of Oswald before the live cameras of the National Broadcasting Company. Concern that John F. Kennedy's assassination was the work not of a lone gunman but of a conspiracy escalated, as did concern about where, in Russia, in Cuba, the conspiracy might have originated. Lyndon Johnson's ascent to the presidency, says presidential historian Henry Graff, came at the most traumatic moment in American political history. And the assassination's impact was magnified by television during the next 3 days, days of funeral ceremonies for the dead president unrivaled in American history for their pageantry and poignance. During the day of the assassination and the 3 days following, television in the average American home was tuned to the Kennedy funeral ceremonies for almost 8 hours a day. The events in modern American history most comparable in their impact on the public, social scientists found, were Pearl Harbor and Franklin Roosevelt's death. But the scientists also found that because these events had occurred before the television age, they were not, in fact, comparable. The pervasiveness, as well as the immediacy of television coverage. There were times during those days when a majority of all Americans were apparently looking at the same events and hearing the same words, participating together in a great national event, the scientists concluded. Nothing like this on such a scale had ever occurred before. Made the assassination and the ceremonies following it an event probably without parallel in history. Adding to the difficulties was the attitude toward the new president among many, most in fact, of the late president's advisers, the men on whom Johnson would have to rely for advice and for the operation of the government. So smoothed over have their feelings been during the intervening decades that in recollections today they bear little resemblance to reality, which was that at the time Lyndon Johnson stepped into office, these men not only disliked and despised him, held him in contempt remarkable in its depth and intensity, but were aware also of what they considered indications of how President Kennedy himself had felt about him, feelings also not at all like those that have come down to us in history. It was a matter of common knowledge around the White House, for instance, that although the vice president was a member of the group, XCOM it was called, convened to advise John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the vice president had been excluded from the meeting at which the final decision about the American response had been made. And there was yet another circumstance that made this transition unique in American history. The murdered president had a brother who hated the new president, as the new president hated him. This book is therefore also the story of Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy, one of the great blood feuds in American political history. It was a feud that arose out of something visceral, something deep within both men, those who witnessed their first face-to-face encounter in the Senate cafeteria in 1953, when Robert Kennedy was only a young Senate staffer and Lyndon Johnson was the mighty majority leader, would never forget it. And over the years, it had only intensified. Lyndon Johnson never forgot or forgave, could never, until he died, stop talking about Robert Kennedy's visits to his hotel room during the 1960 Democratic Convention to try to force him off the ticket. Possessing during his brother's presidency the power to humiliate Johnson, Bobby Kennedy had taken many opportunities to do so. And now, in a single instant, in the crack of a Dallas gunshot, their positions had been reversed, tables turned completely, and Lyndon Johnson had the power to repay the favor, which he soon began to do. Adding still another element to the feud was a factor that seemed likely to make the transition especially problematical. During the final year before the assassination, it had become apparent that the brother had set his sights on becoming president himself one day, perhaps on succeeding John Kennedy after his presidency was over. Should he decide now to mount a challenge to Johnson, he might have on his side, in addition to the Kennedy name and aura and the sympathy engendered by the assassination, the support of most of his brother's White House staff and cabinet, as well as of political leaders across the country who had been members of the Kennedy camp since 1960. While ordinarily a sitting president could easily turn back any challenge to his renomination from within his party, this would be no ordinary challenge. Particularly if, with November 1964 so close upon him, Jack Kennedy's death was also the first death of a president to have occurred so late in his term, the challenge of assuming office and then running for election in the same first year made Johnson's transition unprecedented in American history, says presidential historian Richard Neustadt. The new president should prove unable to quickly unify the Democratic Party behind him. Years later, during his retirement, Johnson would speak of the thing I feared from the first day of my presidency, an announcement by Robert Kennedy of his intention to reclaim the throne in memory of his brother. Were these not enough complications to imperil a transition? There was yet another. Scandal. Scandal on the grand scale. A pair of scandals on that scale had been looming over the vice president for months, and were both coming to a head on the morning of November 22nd. One involving Johnson's protege Bobby Baker, known in Washington as Little Lyndon, had during the weeks before the assassination become a sensational cover story in national magazines. Baker was later to say that if he had talked, Johnson might have incurred a mortal wound by these revelations. They could have driven him from office. But he hadn't talked yet, nor had any of his associates, and as a result the vice president had not been directly implicated. But on the morning of November 22nd, at the very time that the motorcade was carrying Kennedy and Johnson through Dallas, back in Washington, that had been about to change. And at the same time, the other scandal, potentially even larger in scope, was escalating to a new stage in New York, in a conference at the offices of Life magazine, where a team of 9 reporters had been working for weeks on a series of articles with the working title of Lyndon Johnson's Money. Editors were dividing up areas for final investigation and trying to decide whether to run the first article in the next week's issue, which would shortly go to press, when suddenly, all over Life's newsroom, phones began ringing frantically, and a secretary ran into the office shouting the news. And finally, and most significantly, there was the situation on Capitol Hill. For all John F. Kennedy's remarkable ability, his eloquence on the podium, whether for a speech or a press conference, to inspire a nation, to rally it to its better, most humane aspirations, and for all his triumphs in dealing with the rest of the world, the Peace Corps, the nuclear test ban treaty, the Cuban Missile Crisis, few of his domestic goals that required legislation had been turned into reality. And at the time of his death, every major administration bill that was before Congress was stalled in Congress. Even the 2 bills that in 1963 the young president had lumped together as his first priority. A civil rights bill and a tax reduction bill vital not only to the expansion of the economy, but to liberal aims, since economic expansion and the resultant increase in tax revenues were necessary if government was to fund new social welfare programs. The coalition blocking his bills, the Southern Democrat-Republican coalition, the conservative coalition that had ruled Capitol Hill for a quarter of a century, in November 1963 was ruling Capitol Hill still. During the last week or two before the president's trip to Texas, in fact, the stalemate in Congress, the press had taken to calling it a logjam, had escalated to new historic levels. Both the bills were stalled, caught in a logjam that on the day John F. Kennedy died, gave no signs of breaking up. But the story of Lyndon Johnson's transition is a story not only of difficulties he faced, but how he surmounted them. He not only broke the congressional logjam, he broke it up fast, and he broke it up on civil rights. Civil rights had always crystallized liberals' doubts about Lyndon Johnson. What they knew about him, besides his southern roots and accent, the magnolia drawl that raised the hackles on liberal necks, was his southern record, a 20-year record that had begun with his arrival in Congress in 1937 and lasted through 1956, on civil rights, a perfect 100% record of voting against every civil rights bill that had ever made it to the floor, even bills aimed at ending lynching, and a record, moreover, as a Southern strategist, protege of the chieftain of the mighty Southern caucus, Richard Brevard Russell, who had helped Russell ensure that most civil rights bills never made it to the floor. In 1957, in a dramatic reversal of that record, Majority Leader Johnson had rammed through the first civil rights bill to pass Congress since 1875. Significant though that breakthrough was, however, and though he passed another civil rights bill in 1960, liberal antagonism toward him had been softened scarcely at all, since the bills were weak, only meager advances toward social justice, and because his championing of them was regarded by most liberals as mere political opportunism, an attempt to lessen Northern opposition to his presidential candidacy. But although the cliché says that power always corrupts, what is seldom said, but what is equally true, is that power always reveals. When a man is climbing, trying to persuade others to give him power, concealment is necessary. To hide traits that might make others reluctant to give him power, to hide also what he wants to do with that power. If men recognized the traits or realized the aims, they might refuse to give him what he wants. But as a man obtains more power, camouflage is less necessary. The curtain begins to rise. The revealing begins. When Lyndon Johnson had accumulated enough power to do something, a small something, for civil rights in the Senate, he had done it, inadequate though it may have been. Now, suddenly, he had a lot more power, and it didn't take him long to reveal at least part of what he wanted to do with it. On the evening of November 26th, the advisers gathered around the dining room table in his home to draft the speech he was to deliver the following day to a joint session of Congress, were arguing about the amount of emphasis to be given to civil rights in that speech, his first major address as president. As Johnson sat silently listening, most of these advisers were warning that he must not emphasize the subject because it would antagonize the Southerners who controlled Congress and whose support he would need for the rest of his presidency, and because a civil rights bill had no chance of passage anyway. And then in the early hours of the morning, as one of those advisers recalls, one of the wise, practical people around the table told him to his face that a president shouldn't spend his time and power on lost causes, no matter how worthy those causes might be. "Well, what the hell's the presidency for?" Lyndon Johnson replied. In his speech the next day, sympathy for the martyred president was enlisted to advance the cause, as was America's desire for continuity, for stability, for reassurance that the government was holding to a firm course despite the loss of the man who had sat at its head. Invoking Kennedy's name, he said that, "No words are strong enough to express our determination to continue the forward thrust of America that he began. That this is our challenge, to continue on our course. And that no memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. We have talked long enough in this country about equal rights. We have talked for 100 years or more. It is time now to write the next chapter, and to write it in the books of law." Writing it into these books would require more than sympathy, always a highly fungible emotion in politics anyway, and, as will be seen, one that had no influence whatsoever on the Southern Committee chairman who ruled Congress. Strategy was necessary, too. A strategy on the grand scale, and, as will be seen, Johnson had one. A brilliant overview of a means of getting a civil rights bill passed that he had urged on Kennedy only to be ignored. As he had demonstrated in the Senate, moreover, it was not only strategy but tactics of which he was a master. Identifying and throwing his weight behind a seldom-used procedural lever, perhaps the only lever that could have worked, within a month after he had taken office, he had broken the civil rights bill free of the congressional logjam. The bill wouldn't be passed until 1964. It would be passed then only after a half year of struggle, whose heroes included not only liberal congressmen and senators, but the men, women, and children who marched and protested and who, many of them were beaten and tortured, and some of them murdered, on the streets of the South. But it was a struggle whose strategy and day-by-day tactics were laid out and directed by him, and by the end of that first month it was at least on the road to passage. By the end of that month, the tax cut bill was also on the road to passage. And by the end of that month, by the time he left Washington for a Christmas vacation on his Texas ranch, he had won another victory on a third bill, defeating a seemingly innocuous measure involving the sale of wheat to Russia that would have curtailed the president's authority in foreign affairs. Grasping the instant he heard about the bill that it had been introduced because conservatives, emboldened by their victories over Kennedy, were confident that they could defeat a president, that, as he put it, "they've got the bit in their teeth and thought they could bully me the way they believed they had bullied Kennedy," he decided in that instant that the way to yank out the bit was to make the bill a test of strength with Congress, and to win the test. A simple majority wasn't going to be enough to teach Congress a lesson. "I hope that bill gets murdered," he snarled. And sitting in the Oval Office, he kept telephoning senator after senator, cajoling, bullying, threatening, charming, long after he had the majority, to make the vote overwhelming enough to ensure the lesson was clear. The vote was overwhelming, and when, a week later, conservatives attempted a maneuver that would have overturned it, Johnson had a maneuver of his own ready. His tactic was so risky that congressional leaders warned him not to use it. He used it and murdered the bill once and for all. At that moment, the power of the federal government began flowing back to the White House, he was to say. And, boastful though that statement might be, it was true. To watch Lyndon Johnson deal with Congress during the transition, to watch him break the unbreakable conservative coalition, is to see a president fighting not merely with passion and determination, but with something more, with a particular talent, a talent for winning the passage of legislation, in this case legislation that would write into the books of law a measure of justice for millions of people to whom justice had been too long denied, that was more than talent, that was a gift and a very rare one. To watch Lyndon Johnson during the transition is to see political genius in action. He handled all the problems, the Kennedy men's antipathy, the Kennedy brothers' hatred, the rumors over the assassination that, had they not been diffused, might have escalated into international crisis, with the same sureness of touch. If the story of the 5 years is a story of failure, the story of the 7 weeks is a story of what rose out of failure, triumph. So on one level, the biographical level, the recounting of the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the two stories in this book are really one story. A narrative with a single sweeping arc. It rises from the depths of a man's life, a period in which, utterly without power, he stands naked to his enemies, a period in which a man who dreads above all else what he calls humiliation suffers what he dreads, day after day. It sweeps up to the heights of that life, as he is catapulted in an instant, in a gunshot, into the power he had always wanted. And he proceeds to demonstrate, almost in the instant he attains that power, how much he is capable of accomplishing with it. If it is to succeed in its purposes, however, this book must explore another level as well. This is the fourth in a series of volumes that I called The Years of Lyndon Johnson, because it attempts to portray not only his life, but his years, the era in which he lived, rose to the presidency, and finally abandoned the presidency. America in the middle decades of the 20th century, in other words. It tries most particularly to focus on and examine a specific determinative aspect of that era, political power. To explore, through the life of its protagonist, the acquisition and use of various forms of that power during that half-century of American history, and to ascertain also the fundamental realities of that power. To learn what lay, beneath power's trappings, at power's core. The transition period covered in this book is particularly well suited to that purpose, for a way to gain insight into the most fundamental realities of any form of power is to observe it during its moments of deepest crisis, during its most intense struggles, when, under maximum stress, its every resource must be brought to bear, with the undiluted pragmatism born of absolute necessity, if the challenges facing it are to be met. It is at such moments that every one of those resources, every component of that power, is not only visible, but, being used to its utmost, can be observed in all its facets. In trying to understand presidential power, one would find that the transition of 1963, the 7-week-long passage of power between John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson, is one of those moments. Because of the difficult, in some ways unique, challenges facing the incoming chief executive, it was a moment in which the use of presidential power to the limits of its practical, pragmatic possibilities was necessary if the transition was to be successful. Johnson used that power to those limits. To watch him deal with Congress, deal with the Kennedys, confront a dozen other challenges for which there was no precedent, for which he had to create his own precedents, is to watch a president in very difficult circumstances triumph over them, and it is therefore a means of gaining a new insight into some fundamental realities about the pragmatic potential in the American presidency. And about potential beyond the pragmatic. Brief though the transition period was, during it Lyndon Johnson not only rescued his predecessor's programs, but launched one of his own. Barely into his second month in office, he seized on a concept that had just begun to surface, a suggestion, a gleam in the eyes of a few members of the Kennedy administration that the late president had endorsed in theory but had done almost nothing to push forward. Seized on it the moment a Kennedy advisor mentioned it to him, seized on it with such passion, so spontaneous, instinctive and intuitive and uncalculated, that the advisor knew in that moment that he had been very wrong about Lyndon Johnson. Enlarging it far beyond anything previously envisioned, he pushed it forward, prodded his advisors into bringing their imagination to bear on it, and in the second major speech of his presidency, the State of the Union address he delivered to Congress on January 8, 1964, announced it. And it was a program whose title, however hyperbolic, made clear that he viewed it, this crude, coarse, ruthless, often cruel man, who all his life had made a mantra of pragmatism, "It's not the job of a politician to go around saying principled things," as nothing less than a crusade. It was a crusade for a noble end. The speech made clear on whose behalf the crusade would be launched. Unfortunately, many Americans live on the outskirts of hope, some because of their poverty and some because of their color, and all too many because of both, he said in that State of the Union address. Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity. This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America. The speech made clear also the weapons he was going to deploy in the crusade, and the enemies, ancient enemies hitherto invincible, whom he named by name, that he intended the crusade to conquer. Our chief weapons will be better schools and better health and better homes and better training and better job opportunities to help more Americans, especially young Americans, escape from squalor and misery and unemployment, he said. And the speech announced also the crusade's goal, which was revolutionary. Not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it. By the time Lyndon Johnson stepped down from the dais after that speech, it was apparent that the program to which he was committing his still-infant administration was one whose purpose was to right, on a vast scale, vast wrongs, to use to an extent rare in history a great nation's wealth to ameliorate the harshness of life for a portion of its citizens, a substantial portion. One-fifth of America's 150 million citizens in 1964 was 30 million people, too often overlooked by government in the past. It was clear that this was a program whose aim was to launch America on a course toward social justice that, were it to be completed, would result in nothing less than a society's transformation. If, as Martin Luther King Jr. had said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." During the two centuries since the United States of America had come into existence, the arc had bent slowly indeed. During those transition weeks, and in fact during the following years, as Lyndon Johnson widened the war on poverty by introducing legislation on a dozen fronts to transform not just low-income America, but the nation as a whole into the great society, one can see the new president trying to bend it faster. That State of the Union speech, delivered 47 days, just short of 7 weeks after the assassination of John Kennedy, marked the moment when Lyndon Johnson, moving beyond a continuation of Kennedy's policies, made the presidency fully his own. So it is therefore the event that signifies the end of the transition, the moment when the passage of power from Kennedy to Johnson is completed. And to see Lyndon Johnson take hold of presidential power and so quickly begin to use it for ends so monumental is to see with unusual clarity the immensity of the potential an American president possesses to effect transformative change in the nation he leads. Little of that potential, those possibilities, was to be realized. This book is not the story of Lyndon Johnson's 5-year presidency as a whole, but only of its brief first phase. And the longer story will not be a triumphant one. His presidency would, as I have written, be marked by victories. His great personal victory, his election in November 1964 to the presidency in his own right, by what was then and, as of this writing almost half a century later, is still the greatest popular majority ever won by a candidate for the American presidency, and his great legislative victories. Taken as a whole, the bills passed between the beginning of 1964 and the end of 1968 make the Johnson presidency one which saw the legislative realization of many of the noblest aspirations of the liberal spirit in America. Not only the two great civil rights measures, but Medicare and Medicaid, and the 60 separate education laws, including the act that created Head Start, However inadequately thought through and in some cases flawed and contradictory some of these measures might have been due to the haste with which he pushed them through, they were laws of which liberals had dreamed for decades, laws that embodied government's responsibility to fulfill what Johnson's father, the populist legislator, believed was the highest duty of government, to help people caught in the tentacles of circumstance. Yet victories would not, as I have written, be the only hallmarks that would make the presidency of Lyndon Johnson vivid in history. Civil rights, the war on poverty, Medicare, Head Start. But Vietnam. Vietnam and the credibility gap. The loss of trust in the presidency, a belief in what the president was saying, escalated under Richard Nixon, Johnson's successor. But it began under Johnson. And there were other casualties. The cost of the Vietnam War had to be borne by the same national treasury that was funding the war on poverty. And the implications of that fact for liberal dreams would be devastating. Monumental as were some of the achievements of Lyndon Johnson's administration, they were as nothing beside the dreams he had enunciated in that first State of the Union speech. Although there would be many reasons that the poverty war was lost, one of the main reasons was the Asian War. The transition period on which we are concentrating in this volume contains the seeds of all that was to follow. Few as they were, the decisions that Lyndon Johnson made about Vietnam during these 7 weeks, he was, as will be seen, making every effort to keep them few, to tamp down Vietnam as a political issue until after the November 1964 election, nonetheless display the secrecy and deceit that were to play such a large role in making Vietnam and Johnson's presidency a tragic drama. But the story of Lyndon Johnson during the opening transition weeks of his presidency is a triumphant story, one in which it is possible to glimpse the full possibilities of presidential power, of that power exercised by a master in the use of power, in a way that is visible only a few times in American history. Part 1. Johnson versus Kennedy, 1960. Chapter 1. The Prediction. When he was young, 17 and 18 years old, Lyndon Johnson worked on a road gang that was building a highway, an unpaved highway. Roads in the isolated, impoverished Texas Hill Country weren't paved in the 1920s, between Johnson City and Austin. With little mechanical equipment available, the road was being built almost entirely by hand. And his job, when he wasn't half of a pick-and-shovel team with Ben Crider, a burly friend, 6 years older, from Johnson City, was driving a Fresno, a heavy two-handled metal scoop with a sharpened front edge that was pulled by 4 mules. Standing behind the scoop, between its handles, as the mules strained forward to force the scoop through the hard hill country caliche soil, he would push as they pulled. Since he needed a hand for each handle, the reins were tied together and wrapped around his back. So for this work, hard for even older men, for a tall, skinny, awkward teenager it was, the other men recall, back-breaking labor, too heavy for Lyndon. Lyndon Johnson was, really, in harness with the mules. But at lunch hour each day, as the gang sat eating, in summer, in whatever shade they could find as protection from the blazing hill country sun, in winter, huddled around a fire, it would get so cold, Crider recalls, that you had to build a fire to thaw your hands before you could handle a pick and shovel, build us a fire and thaw and work all day. Lyndon would, in the words of another member of the gang, talk big to the older men. He had big ideas. He wanted to do something big with his life. And he was quite specific about what he wanted to do. "I'm going to be President of the United States one day," he predicted. Poverty and backbreaking work, clearing cedar on other men's farms for $2 a day, or chopping and picking cotton on your hands and knees all day beneath that searing sun, were woven deep in the fabric of Lyndon Johnson's youth, as were humiliation and fear. He was coming home at night to a house to which other Johnson City families brought charity in the form of cooked dishes, because there was no money in that house to buy food. to a house on which, moreover, his family was having such difficulty paying the taxes and mortgage that they were afraid it might not be theirs much longer. But woven into it also was that prediction. In many ways, his whole life would be built around that prediction, around a climb toward that single far-off goal. As a young congressman in Washington, he was careful not to mention that ambition to the rising young New Dealers with whom he was allying himself, but they were aware of it anyway. James H. Roe, Jr., Franklin Roosevelt's aide, who spent more time with Johnson than the others, says, "From the day he got here, he wanted to be president. When old friends from Texas visited him, sometimes his determination burst out of him despite himself, as if he could not contain it. 'By God, I'll be president someday,' he exclaimed one evening when he was alone with Welly Hopkins." And an incident in 1940 showed the Texans how much he wanted the prize he sought, how much he was willing to sacrifice to attain it. Lack of money had been the cause of so many of the insecurities of his youth, and his election to Congress, far from soothing those fears, had seemed only to intensify them. He talked incessantly about how his father, who had been an elected official himself, a six-term member of the Texas House of Representatives, had ended up as a state bus inspector and had died penniless. He didn't want to end up like his father, he said. He talked about how he kept seeing around Washington former congressmen who had lost their seats, as, he said, he would inevitably one day lose his, and were working in low-paying, demeaning jobs. Over and over again, he related how once, while he was riding in an elevator in the Capitol, the elevator operator had told him that he had been a congressman. Hungry for money, he had already started accepting, indeed soliciting, financial favors from businessmen who wanted favors from him, and had been pleading with two important businessmen, George R. Brown of the Texas contracting firm of Brown and Root, and the immensely wealthy Austin publisher, real estate magnate, and oil man Charles Marsh, to find him a business in which he could make a little money of his own. So when, one autumn day in 1940, the three men, Johnson, Brown, and Marsh, were vacationing together at the luxurious Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia, lying on a blanket in front of their adjoining cottages, and Marsh offered Lyndon Johnson a business in which he could make a lot of money, the two businessmen were sure the congressman would accept it. Marsh, who in Brown's words, loved Lyndon like a son, told him he could have his share in a lucrative oil field partnership, a share worth $750,000, without even putting up any money. He could pay for it out of his profits each year. To the surprise of both men, however, Johnson said that he would have to think about the offer, and after a week he turned it down. "I can't be an oil man," he said. "If the public knew he had oil interests, it would kill me politically." Believing they understood Johnson's political ambitions, Johnson was always telling them about how he wanted to stay in the House until a Senate seat opened up, and then run for the Senate, and about how the Senate seat was his ultimate goal in politics. Never had he mentioned any other office, nor did he mention one during his week at the Greenbrier. Marsh and Brown were shocked by his refusal. Being known as an oil man couldn't hurt him in his congressional district or in a Senate race in oil-dominated Texas. But then they realized that there was, in fact, one office for which he would be killed by being an oil man. And then they understood that while Lyndon Johnson might hunger for money, that hunger was as nothing beside his hunger for something else. And unlike others, the many, many others in Washington who wanted the same thing he did, who had set their sights on the same goal, Lyndon Baines Johnson, born August 27, 1908, had mapped out a path to that goal, and he refused to be diverted from it. The path ran only through Washington. It was paved with national, not state power, and it had only three steps: House of Representatives, Senate, Presidency. And after he had fought his way into it, winning a seat in the House in 1937 in a desperate, seemingly hopeless campaign, he could not be persuaded by anyone, not even Franklin Roosevelt, to turn it off. In 1939, the president offered to appoint him director of the New Deal's Rural Electrification Administration, the directorship of a nationwide agency, particularly one as fast-growing and politically important as the REA, was not the kind of job offered to many men only 30 years old. But Johnson turned the offer down. He was afraid, he said, of being sidetracked. In 1946, he was urged by his party to run for the governorship of Texas. If he did, he knew his election was all but assured, and at the time his path seemed to have reached a dead end in Washington. Stuck in the House now for almost a decade, with little chance of any imminent advancement to its hierarchy, he seemed to have no chance of stepping into a Senate seat. In the 435-member House, he was still only one of the crowd of junior congressmen, and as a woman who worked with him when